From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. For months, the news in Iraq had been of bombings and beheadings, ambushes and assassinations, a guerrilla war defined by the guerrillas. But suddenly last week, it was war once again, war American style, and certainly American media style.
Threatened for months, brewing for weeks, imminent for days. Now it is underway. The Pentagon calls it Phantom Fury, a shock and awe Army, Marine, U.S., and Iraqi campaign to retake Fallujah.
The first objective for the Marines that we're embedded with is to take this apartment complex behind me. They're sweeping it for potential insurgents, to clear out civilians, and they're also looking for improvised explosive devices.
The first objective of the first wave of Marines, however, was not an apartment complex. It was a hospital, which American officials complained was controlled by insurgents for use primarily as a propaganda mill. In April, the first attempt to retake Fallujah was aborted after the hospital's reports of widespread civilian casualties inflamed international outrage. It's not clear that those numbers were inflated because in Iraq, it seems nobody agrees on anything, neither the enemies nor the allies. This was Army General George W. Casey on Monday, briefing reporters on the latest developments in Operation Phantom Fury. Not Operation Phantom Fury.
The name of the operation is an Arabic name. It's Al-Fajr, and it's the Iraqi word for dawn. And the Iraqi prime minister selected this for obvious reasons.
Of course, this was, after all, a pacifying operation, and Phantom Fury sounded so destructive and furious. The cable news networks adjusted their scrolls accordingly. It was one of the many reminders throughout the week that the information warfare would be as fierce as the street fighting. And for the Iraqi government, priority number one was conveying the idea that they weren't mere American collaborators, but were actually in charge. The press didn't necessarily bite, but they obliged at least by passing along heroic pictures and storylines.
Videotape of a flag raising by soldiers of Iraq's 1st Brigade was replayed at a press briefing near Fallujah, featuring both a U.S. and Iraqi general.
We have some breaking news coming out of Iraq. This is from near Fallujah. It's from the commander of the Iraqi forces there. He says that they have found what they're calling hostage slaughterhouses in Fallujah. This is where they say foreign captives were held and killed. They found a number of the black clothing used that the captors would use to identify themselves, hundreds of CDs and records with names of hostages.
No hostages were actually found there, and the Iraqis furnished no evidence that the hostages were killed there, but challenged the official story at your own peril. On Thursday, Iraq's media regulator invoked the state of emergency declared prior to the Fallujah assault and ordered news organizations to stick to the government line or face legal action. Specifically, the media were told to distinguish between insurgents and ordinary residents of Fallujah, the civilians being the ones who were unharmed by the assault.
General Tom Metz says the enemy has suffered significant losses, greater than the U.S. military anticipated. He said there have been very few civilian casualties.
But it wasn't just that the enemy had suffered heavy casualties. Pentagon spokesman broke with decades of military doctrine by issuing body counts, which the media dutifully reported.
Mop-up operations are expected to last another day or two. U.S. casualties are still described as light, with enemy dead put at more than 500.
The commander of U.S. forces there says that up to 600 insurgents have been killed, along with 18 American and 5 Iraqi soldiers.
Suddenly, it sounded so familiar. Body counts, a la Vietnam, and homegrown soldiers doing their share, like the South Vietnamese Army. And reporters not knowing who to believe. And just when the battle zone comes under American control, more bad news from somewhere else, in Mosul and Ramadi, and another place, the seat of Iraqi government.
Tonight, armed insurgents also have a very visible presence in several neighborhoods in Baghdad. Some residents are calling parts of the capital mini Fallujah.
Perhaps the next pacification operation will be there. Before then, however, some of the public opinion molders at the Pentagon would be well advised to look up the word phantom.
The other big story this week also centered on the Middle East. It was, of course, the death of a man who dominated the headlines for 30 years, lightning rod, media darling, Yasser Arafat.
A short guy who's not very good looking, who has a 3-day growth of beard, is not our idea of a media idol. But he certainly traded Che Guevara's beret for the keffiyeh and symbolized the Palestinians.
Lawrence Pintak, CBS correspondent in Lebanon in the early 80s, is now a professor at the University of Michigan. Arafat, he says, was the consummate actor, an entertainer who, from his emergence in the 60s, knew how to play the press. He displayed that gift in 1968, spinning the story of a standoff with the Israelis in Jordan into a triumph as great, he said, as the Soviet victory over the Germans at Stalingrad. The tale landed him a Time magazine cover, the first act in a career that made theater of politics.
The epitome of that was his appearance at the UN, his so-called gun in the olive branch speech.
Arafat said he had an olive branch in one hand and a freedom fighter's gun. He actually held an olive branch, but because of UN regulations.
His holster literally was empty. And that just summed the whole thing up. He understood what reporters were looking for.
But it was an event 2 years earlier that focused the world's attention on the Palestinian cause. Then the stage was not the United Nations, but the 1972 Munich Olympics, and the drama was drenched in blood.
This scene in the Olympic Village today became the symbol of man's inhumanity to man, as an organization called the Black September Movement, a Palestine guerrilla organization, scaled the fences of the Olympic compound and, with machine guns blazing, entered the Israeli housing compound, killed two men, and are still holding hostages.
The Palestinians didn't invent the idea of this symbiotic relationship between terror and the media. They certainly perfected it at Munich. And that immediately vaulted the Palestinian cause to the top of the UN agenda. Literally hundreds of millions of people watched the drama, and they were on stage, and they never really left the stage after that.
And so, against a lurid and bewildering backdrop of violence committed by and against his people, Palestine's public face was center stage in the spotlight and scrupulously on message.
From the very first time I interviewed him in 1979, I sensed this calculating mind. How is this interview going to appear?
Philadelphia Inquirer columnist Trudy Rubin covered Arafat for a quarter century.
The translator in that interview was Shafiq Al-Hout. And Arafat, who at that time could speak less English than he could speak in later years, was correcting Shafiq's translation, although Shafiq was a fluent English speaker. Obviously, he understood enough English to want to make sure that the message was just what he wanted to say, and it didn't really matter what the question was.
He tailored his demeanor to fit the message and its intended audience. It could be an audience of millions. It could be an audience of one.
So he had a whole repertoire of characters in a way that he would be at any given time and always with its same genuineness and authenticity from one moment to the next.
Robert Malley was a Mideast negotiator for President Clinton from 1998 to 2001. He recalls one famously testy meeting between Arafat and then-Secretary of State Madeleine Albright.
Almost taking us by surprise, he got up, said, if this is how this meeting is going to proceed, I'm going to leave. And he just slammed the door and left. And an hour later, he saw her and President Clinton together, and he made sure to embrace Madeleine Albright, Secretary Albright, and to show President Clinton that not only was he forgiving, but he wanted forgiveness.
But Arafat only sought forgiveness privately of an American president. To the West, his public face flickered. Sometimes it assumed the aspect of a statesman, resolved to find a safe haven for his people. Here he speaks on the Oslo Peace Accords in 1994.
Our people do not consider that exercising the right to self-determination could violate the rights of their neighbors or infringe on their security. Rather, putting an end to their feelings of being wronged and of having suffered an historic injustice is the strongest guarantee to achieve coexistence and openness between our two peoples and future generations.
But that measured performance played better in the West than it did at home. The Arabic media would frequently portray Arafat the statesman as a sellout, a man who would trade their future for a handshake with a prime minister. On the public stage, before an audience at odds, he was panned even as he was praised. Even worse, though he could shape the message, he had no control over how his audience would receive it. Robert Malley.
The problem is, when Arafat spoke tough at home, the people at home discounted it, believed he was just saying it because he wanted to act tough, whereas the Israelis believed every word he was saying. And when an Israeli prime minister spoke tough, like Ehud Barak was saying, we're not going to give in, his own constituency, his right wing, would say he's just saying it in order to placate us, and the Palestinians would believe every word he was saying.
So, invariably, Arafat the statesman reverted to Arafat the extremist. He walked out of the Camp David peace talks and became, at least in Western eyes, the man for whom compromise, and therefore peace, was not an option. Yasser Arafat offered his defiance to the Israelis in October 2000.
My response is our people is continuing their road to Jerusalem, the capital of our independent Palestinian state. To accept or not to accept, let him go to hell.
He never transferred from the old Arafat to the new one, to the statesman, to the pragmatic leader who could deliver.
Tekla Shemansky was, in recent years, senior editor for Western Europe and the Middle East for the World Press Review. She says the weak and ailing Arafat had come to symbolize a bygone era.
Somebody trapped in his old way of thinking and not be able to rid himself of his baggage.
If Arafat remains the enduring symbol of the Palestinian people, says Shemansky, it's because he is all they have, really all they have ever had.
And Arafat's mystic figure will float somewhere in the air and he will be a presence. He will be there and I don't think we can get rid of him.
So the fate of the Palestinian people passes to a new generation. Their prospects for peace may hinge on which Arafat they choose to embrace, the terrorist or the pragmatist who came to accept a two-state solution over no solution at all. Robert Malley.
Whoever succeeds will have the burden of Arafat's judgment over everything he or she does. And therefore, if the memory of Arafat is simply as the man who said no, it's going to be that much more difficult to say yes.
Arafat's obituaries are awash in both hatred and hagiography. The final draft of history, whether he'll be judged merely as a pioneer in the use of terror as a publicity tool, or as a patriot who struggled toward yes, will be written by someone else.
Up next, allegations of voter fraud make the news media queasy, and John Ashcroft's swan song.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with a story that scores high on the news media's ick factor. The 2004 presidential election, part two, the vote count. It seems that a sizable number of people, fueled in part by internet-generated outrage, are clamoring for vote count news. I mean, we've got mail, and not just us.
So it is now a week since the country re-elected President Bush, and we've been a little surprised by how many emails we've had suggesting that maybe once again the country got it wrong. Now, we're not particularly disposed to conspiracy theories. As you know, Mr. Bush won by a very comfortable margin of more than 3 million votes. We did think it might be a public service, and quite frankly, cut back on the emails, if our ballot watch correspondent, Jake Tapper, took another look.
On Tuesday, after Peter Jennings' somewhat disdainful intro, Jake Tapper offered a report called Conspiracy Theories Abound After Bush Victory. A Boston Globe headline read, Internet buzz on vote fraud is dismissed. The Washington Post ran a story about the conspiracy theories, so did the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. The New York Times had a piece Friday titled, Vote Fraud Theories Spread by Blogs Are Quickly Buried. The papers are seeing more conspiracies than stories here, but even though none of the alleged ballot shenanigans would change the outcome of the presidential election, to some, they suggest that something is rotten in the state of Denmark. In fact, you can find a long list of ballot irregularities at a website called rottendenmark.blogspot.com.
If there were a Mission Impossible sort of task force assigned to steal an American election, fiddling with it behind the scenes, it would look very much like what we experienced last week. So if you're a rational paranoid, that says, maybe we just better make sure this was kosher.
Mickey Kaus, writer of Kaus Files on Slate.com, says the mainstream media have been a mite slow off the mark, but not because they're afraid of charges of bias.
I think the press has already been accused of being biased for the Democrats. They've learned how to handle that, and I don't think that's the reason. They don't want to seem to be spoil sports, and they don't want to seem to be sore losers. But mainly, like everybody else, they want to put Florida behind them.
They want to put Florida and Ohio and maybe New Hampshire behind them. But for the time being, they can't quite make them go away.
I don't think we have closure yet. We haven't had the definitive, convincing investigative piece. Maybe it came out today and I haven't read it, but I haven't seen a piece that convinces me that everything was on the up and up.
That's because some incidents still defy explanation and aren't being examined, as of Friday anyway, except by one stunningly enthusiastic news anchor. MSNBC's Keith Olbermann is the newly appointed hero of the left, recipient of some 20,000 grateful emails just this week for running a series of investigative pieces about the vote count on his new show, Countdown.
Our fifth story in the Countdown tonight, there is a small but blood-curdling group of reports of voting irregularities and possible fraud, principally in Ohio and Florida. And that group of reports is moving from that end of the spectrum, in which believers are also likely to be wearing hats made out of Reynolds wrap, to the other end of the spectrum, in which the believers are going to the General Accounting Office and perhaps the FBI.
Mickey Kaus.
He's been totally transparent about what he's doing, and he hasn't gone that much beyond where the facts have led him, and he hasn't pretended he's doing anything other than investigating the story. So I think he's behaved responsibly, and he can back off now if it turns out not to be true without any egg on his face. That's what the press is supposed to do. It's supposed to raise questions and answer them.
Keith Olbermann.
Believe me, I didn't start out on a crusade to be the only person who was covering this story. I do not think this is Edward R. Murrow bringing down Joseph McCarthy. I have no illusions about it. I thought it was a story that merited coverage. I don't really have to worry about what other people are doing or not doing. It was looking at it from a point of view of, there's a story here. I happen to have a newscast. Maybe I should cover it.
As for why his colleagues, for the most part, haven't, he also doesn't buy the argument that they're scared. He thinks they're probably just tired.
When John Kerry announced his concession, there were, I don't know, hundreds, thousands of full-time political reporters, perhaps, whose first human reaction to that probably was, great, all I have to do is write this up, and then I get 4 days off. And for many of them, I would think that would be the first consecutive days off since this campaign really got going, which is in March, which made it the longest in American history. And people were dropping like flies. I mean, you saw reporters on television who were literally hoarse, and countless newspaper reporters who looked worse than usual. And I think that the primary reason this didn't get any traction, the reason there was a silence to some degree, was that people were just off.
Another intriguing reason for what he called a deafening silence earlier this week, contempt for blog-generated news.
Any established form of journalism gets really angry when there's a new form of journalism put in, especially if it doesn't play by the rules that the old-fashioned version does, and clearly the internet does not play by those rules. That's the primary problem with the blogs and such.
But his most convincing explanation, to me anyway, is that this story isn't going to change the big story.
In mainstream media, we are very goal-oriented. We don't talk issues or policy or long-term effects. It's, okay, this is not going to impact the outcome of the election because Kerry already conceded. End of story. Let's start talking about the 2008 primaries.
So what story broke through Olbermann's election-weary, blog-leery, goal-oriented defenses? It was about a vote-counting facility in Warren County, Ohio, locked down and closed off to the media on election night due to national security concerns. Reportedly, the FBI said it rated a perfect 10 for danger. The FBI has since denied it ever made that call. What gives? For Olbermann, one suspicious event led to another.
Gaston has become the sixth North Carolina county to revise its vote totals from Election Day. Turnout was not 45% there. It was 57%. They were off by nearly 12,000 votes. Someone, said County Elections Director Sandra Page, forgot to follow the point-and-click procedure.
It probably doesn't matter. Kerry isn't complaining. In fact, Friday's New York Times piece ends with a quote from David Wade, a spokesman for the Kerry campaign, who says, "I'd give my right arm for internet rumors of a stolen election to be true, but blogging it doesn't make it so." Still, The Times reports that lawyers for the Kerry campaign are on a fact-checking trip in Ohio just to erase doubts about the legitimacy of the Ohio vote raised by the blogs. Six Democratic congressmen have asked the Government Accountability Office to investigate irregularities involving touchscreen voting machines. North Carolina may have to re-elect some state officials. Ralph Nader may actually, who knows, be able to pull off a recount in New Hampshire. A slow drip, drip, drip that wouldn't fill a bucket. But maybe if we just stare this thing down, it will work better next time. I don't want a tinfoil hat. Just please, God, give me some closure.
September 11th and the war in Iraq have exposed some of the flaws in U.S. intelligence gathering. Many argue that the solution lies in spending more on the traditional approach of spy versus spy. But now there's a movement to spread that intelligence around. First, the 9/11 Commission report recommended creating an agency to better use open source intelligence, that is, intelligence that is not classified as secret. And bills in both the House and Senate are pushing for the same thing. Why? Because open source intelligence, which is, roughly speaking, the sea of information we swim in all the time, news reports, academic studies, scientific research, all publicly accessible, can tell us much of what we need to know. Charles Cameron has been tracking the rise of open source material as a member of the Rheingold Group, which specializes in the study of social networks. Cameron believes that anyone can be a spy in this brave new open source world. Charles, welcome to the show.
Thank you indeed, Bob.
Proponents of open source intelligence have said that 80% of necessary government intelligence is, quote, not secret, not online, not in English, and not being paid attention to in Washington. It's just sitting there, hidden in plain view?
I wouldn't necessarily add the not online part, but the idea is that a very, very great majority of the stuff that we need to know is stuff that can actually be learned without going through secrecy routes to get it. People are realizing that in order to break out of the groupthink that is very easily achieved in tight organizations like the CIA, it's a wonderful idea to begin to emphasize open source intelligence and bring into the picture the people who are doing very similar work in academia and in the media.
Are you actually suggesting deputizing journalists to do intelligence work for the United States government?
Well, on page 413 of the 9/11 Commission report, there was a little diagram. One of the things that was featured was the words open source agency, brackets, new. And in that agency, it's entirely possible that journalists, as well as some academics, will be among the people who are very suited to do some of the analysis. I don't know what form it's going to take, but I think it's, on the whole, a hopeful sign. And it's a recognition, first of all, that secrecy isn't the grand mark of excellence, that in fact lots and lots of stuff is known and can be discovered, and that one doesn't have to have high classification data in order to do that.
I myself am almost 50 years old. I don't speak Arabic, and I can't keep a secret. Are you suggesting that maybe there's a future for me at the CIA?
I would be hoping that whatever is set up by the government in this regard would be something that doesn't require that you should have any kind of clearances in order to be involved in the business of thinking clearly and letting other people know. My feeling also is that there is important stuff that can be learned from open source information gathering that isn't necessarily in Arabic.
In some ways, isn't it easier to plant spies and steal secrets than to search for little needles in the vast haystack of open sources?
We have very powerful software for sorting through large quantities of data, but there's also the whole other very important issue of human intelligence. And the truth is that at the moment, a human mind that is bright and is able to see patterns is much more useful in some regards than the very best machine.
So much information that one sees in the daily mainstream press, not even to mention the vast amount of information that one finds on the internet, is quickly discredited. Is it not just a Herculean effort to try to make any sense out of this vast sea of information to actually get any practical use out of it?
I don't think so, but I think it's a situation that's confronting us in any case. We don't really have the option of saying, let's turn down the amount of world information to a 20th of what it is today, and then I'll be able to handle things better. You need to be savvy. You need to recognize propaganda and psyops. You need to recognize the various ways in which simplistic or overly complex or overly suspicious or overly naive readings get out there. But still, a bright mind watching a useful display of information from many sources and feeding into a collegial field but not being by any means the only voice in it can come up with useful insights, which, if nothing else, just broaden the discourse in a way that, as I say, helps avoid this groupthink.
All right, Charles. Well, thank you very much.
Well, it was a pleasure to talk to you.
Charles Cameron is a games designer, policy analyst, and reluctant futurist. He spoke to us from Glendale, California.
Before, from rocky coast to golden shore, let the mighty eagle soar.
You've probably heard that a lot this week. It is, of course, Attorney General John Ashcroft singing praise. Recently, though, he's been singing a different tune, one of bitterness and defensiveness, coinciding with his resignation as Attorney General. Bob looked back on his tenure, which not infrequently has been the stuff of melodrama.
Goodbyes are never easy, least of all for John Ashcroft. This week, he used his resignation letter plaintively to list his successes as Attorney General, as if to ask how so much effort, so much passion, so much law enforcement could have resulted in so little love. In fact, wasn't there a song about that?
I must have done something
good. Well, thanks to Ashcroft and his fellow singing senators, Capitol Hill was alive with the sound of music. He was a regular Baron von Trapp, maybe a humorless, inflexible disciplinarian on the surface, but with what underneath? 4 years ago, this was what his confirmation hearings set out to discover. Unfortunately, the Senate Judiciary Committee Democrats didn't ask him to sing. They asked him to explain giving an interview to a magazine called Southern Partisan, which had once printed stories with a nostalgic take on, slavery.
Is the Southern Partisan magazine racist in your opinion?
I probably should do more due diligence on it. I know they've been accused of being racist.
I got that, Jim.
Still, he was confirmed, vowing to diligently uphold the Constitution. A very good opportunity to get started might have been the Enron scandal, but as it turned out, Ashcroft couldn't personally prosecute the bosses, because they were big campaign contributors.
I've made clear that I believe that the Justice Department and its function should be undertaken by others, and I will have no involvement in the matter because of my recusal.
While he wasn't attending to a multi-billion dollar swindle, Ashcroft did keep busy, barring press interviews with condemned bomber Timothy McVeigh and battling Armageddon. Cornhole Armageddon, to be precise. A porn film. Corporate crime was running rampant, but the Attorney General zeroed right in on Depravity in Deutschland and Ass Clowns 3. September 11th, of course, changed everything. Now a wartime law enforcement official, General Ashcroft started rounding up foreigners and detaining them without hearing, without legal counsel, without charges, and without public scrutiny of any kind.
Climb every mountain, search high and low, follow every byway, every path you know.
The Patriot Act gave the Attorney General broad powers to curtail basic civil rights, including protection from arbitrary search and seizure and domestic surveillance, all in absolute secrecy. Ashcroft responded to the outrage of civil libertarians by demanding more powers still, such as Operation Tips, which asked UPS men and other brown shirts to spy on their fellow Americans.
Lieutenant! Lieutenant, they're here! They're here, Lieutenant!
Ashcroft lost a big battle with proposed follow-up legislation commonly known as Son of Patriot Act, or as even the Republican Congress thought of it, Ask Clowns 2. His rationale was that these law enforcement tools had helped prosecute more than 100 suspicious characters. What he failed to understand was that these tools also terrorized thousands of innocents. Later, in the wake of Abu Ghraib, Ashcroft was hauled before Congress to be lectured on why, despite Justice Department memos suggesting otherwise, his country does not sanction torture. And his investigation into White House leaks, ostensibly to find who disclosed classified information for partisan purposes, has resulted in two jail sentences for journalists. John. We don't know what further excesses are in store with your replacement, but you can't worry about that now, Mr. Attorney General. Run, John, run. Run and sing. In fact, let's all sing.
So long.
Coming up, the Hacks Hack, Jimmy Breslin, and taking a whack at lesser hacks.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with a few of your letters. We had a lot of appreciative mail last week in response to our look back at freedom of information during the president's first term. Most of them simply said thanks. Some were more effusive, but modesty forbids. There were, however, some people who took issue with our story on the C word, verboten slang for part of a woman's anatomy. Our piece concerned an incident at the Chicago Tribune where a story about the word gave editors cold feet, causing staffers to pull the offending section from that day's paper by hand.
Listener Thomas O'Haron of Silver Spring, Maryland wrote, "Last night I listened with admiration and gratitude to On the Media's terrific items on the election, government secrecy, and Iraqi casualties. And then came a big letdown with the silly piece on the C word. What was the point? I couldn't discern one. This piece could epitomize the blue state, red state divide. Perhaps only a few New Yorkers were offended, but I'm sure that thousands of their red state fellow citizens were puzzled and disappointed, if not infuriated."
And on our discussion of exit polls last week, Thomas Talbot from New York City had this to say. "Your story, handled with care, reports that in 2000 and 2004, exit polls got the results wrong. In 2000, they got it right. Exit polls measure voters' intentions. They do not measure whether voters were confused by butterfly ballots or whether they were inept at punching out chads of paper from voting cards. In 2000, a majority of Florida voters intended to vote for Gore. The exit polls reflected this reality. The vote count, as a result of the many foul-ups reported at the time, did not."
Robert Funicello from Mamaroneck, New York, writes in with a comment on our piece about newspaper endorsements. He writes, "As a person who has been interested in electoral politics since Ike roared past me down Mamaroneck Avenue in a convertible in 1952, I enjoyed your piece on the role of newspaper endorsements in presidential elections. But I think you missed a key point, that editorial endorsements are important not because they change votes, but because they accurately reflect voter opinion. Indeed, it may well be that editorial endorsements have never really influenced elections, but have been misinterpreted as doing so because they so accurately predicted the outcome."
Send your predictions and interpretations to onthemedia@wnyc.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. ¶¶ Meaningless, underhanded, vapid, shameless, pointlessly vicious, degrading, one of the most prolonged insults to human dignity the world has ever seen. These are some of the choice descriptors New York Press columnist Matt Taibbi reserves for the quadrennial ritual of American democracy recently concluded. But instead of sitting idly by, this time Taibbi decided to take action.
Though we're tempted to blame the politicians, it's time to dig deeper. It's time to blame the press corps that daily brings us his unrelenting symphony of buncombe and never comes within 1,000 miles of an apology for any of it. And it's time to blame the press not only as a class of people, but as individuals, who must brand anyone who puts his name or his face on credulous campaign coverage an eternal enemy of the state. Hopefully, over time, this will have a deterrent effect.
And so, Taibbi launched the first quadrennial Election Hack Invitational, otherwise known as Wimble Hack. The rules of the tournament were straightforward. Every week, the journalist who penned the worst coverage advanced into the next round of play. The goal was to determine America's worst campaign reporter, the journalist who truly is the scourge of American democracy.
The way that campaign coverage is designed is that it makes it almost impossible for even the most honest and idealistic reporter to do a good job. I mean, I was on the plane with Kerry for 4 weeks last spring, and you don't have a chance to talk to anybody that the campaign doesn't introduce to you. So all the attention is focused on the candidate. And for 18 months, you're looking at the same, you know, millionaire on both sides who's saying the same, you know, market-tested lines. And instead of spending that 18 months actually looking at the country's problems and listening to what people have to say, we spend the entire time in this plane.
So how do they get those real voices in their pieces?
Well, they don't. I mean, that's the whole point. I mean, when I was with the Kerry plane, what I would do is as soon as we got to a location, I would literally sprint a mile in any direction and just talk to people who were there and ask them if they cared at all about what was going on in the campaign. And 9 times out of 10, people weren't going to vote, were disgusted with the process, but were complaining about real things in their neighborhoods. And then, you know, I'd look down at my watch and it was time for me to go back again. If a reporter wants to actually talk to real people and he's on the plane, that's what he has to do.
They need running shoes.
They need running shoes, yeah.
One of the things that really seemed to get Wimble Hack's blood boiling was the absolute complicity that reporters have in perpetrating the very thing that they say they hate, which is the kind of political bloodlust that wants to see campaigns conducted like cockfights or battle bots.
You would have had to search far and wide to find a debate piece that wasn't just laden with boxing imagery. For instance, Howard Feynman of Newsweek, this is the way he prefaced the debate. He said, "The Kerry people seem to feel they have no choice but to send their man out into the middle of the ring swinging." You know, and then he says, "This is the 8th round of a championship fight of 10 rounds. Now, for obvious entertainment reasons, it works better as theater for the press when the candidates are being really nasty to each other. So what they really try to discourage is candidates who go off on lengthy diatribes about policy. In fact, you'll find, especially in the writings of Times' Karen Tumulty, she consistently derides any candidate who spends too long in polysyllabic speeches about arcane economic or environmental policy.
And she probably comes in for the most vicious invective of anyone in the Wimble Hack contest. Tell me about the Tumulty salt.
Well, Tumulty salt is something that I named after her because she practices it more than anybody else. This is where reporters use a phrase like Kerry's strong environmental record or, you know, Bush's aggressive furthering of his economic policies. And then they don't elaborate.
Go through your papers here and find a perfect Tumulty salt.
Here's a Tumulty salt that was actually written by Tumulty herself in a piece called The Gleam Team on July 19th. And I quote, "When he finished, Kerry couldn't resist jumping in with a mini-seminar on trade policy that included references to the fine print of the anti-dumping and anti-surge laws. But at least Kerry answered the question." And here, she's accomplishing two things. Number one, she's berating him for talking at length about these boring things. And number two, she's talking about the anti-dumping and anti-surge laws without
explaining what
he's saying about them. In other words, the issues and the positions become confined to the words issues and positions.
Now, one thing that a reporter can do to keep from moving into the next round is to go a week without filing anything from the campaign trail. You wrote, the best way to be a better journalist, especially when it comes to the campaign, is not to practice journalism. I think that's a good joke, but doesn't it destroy the entire integrity of your rating system, as if you care?
I don't care, and B, no. I think the problem is the way that this campaign is structured. You're better off just not doing it. It doesn't take 18 months of celebrity coverage of these candidates to educate America on which candidate to vote for. It usually takes about a day for people to decide that. But nobody really sits back and thinks, well, what was this whole 18-month charade really all about?
I really enjoyed reading Wimble Hack, but one thing that I thought really marred it is that you seem to take issue with the way that people looked, especially Jody Wilgerin in the New York Times and Karen Tumulty of Time magazine. Now, these people may be, in your view, terrible reporters, but did you have to take aim at them for their physical flaws?
Well, one of the things that I really hate the most about the media business is that people who are on opposite ends of the political spectrum in public, you know, your right-wing pundit and your left-wing gadfly who appear together on television arguing, no matter what they say in public, everybody's pal once they're off camera. And I just don't believe that that's the right way to go about things. I think that if you really believe in something, there has to be a limit across which you just can't be friends with somebody. Maybe I went over the top with Tumulty and Wilgorin, but I think what I'm trying to say is that I'm not trying to be anybody's friend.
In fact, you're out to lose friends and influence people.
Yeah, I mean, I think if it becomes like a country club event where everybody's chummy with each other, the way the candidate's aides are chummy with the reporters and the candidate is chummy with the reporters, what purpose does that serve for the public? And I think there has to be a line at which it gets personal.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Brooke.
Matt Taibbi is a columnist for the New York Press. The final installment of his Wimble Hack will appear in this week's paper.
This month, the legendary Jimmy Breslin retired from writing his thrice-weekly column for Newsday. It might have passed you by since his final column ran November 2nd, Election Day. His final headline proclaimed, "I'm right again, so I quit." Beautiful. It called the election for John Kerry. If going out on a mistake is embarrassing, Breslin doesn't seem too fussed about it. He may not have been a perfect prognosticator, but there was plenty that he did get right. For over 40 years, his column entertained and infuriated readers with tales of colorful New York City characters and the occasional bombshell investigative piece. John Kalish has a profile of a man famous for his legwork.
I told you that's what it's for. Take them off.
Hello.
Don't forget. I ain't gonna do it.
He was the tabloid voice of the little guy who made a name for himself writing about a flock of characters so colorful they seemed to be fictional. When Breslin won the Pulitzer Prize in 1986, there was a champagne toast in the city room of the New York Daily News. Breslin declared that his success was based on a simple approach.
I still pursue the art of climbing flights of stairs. Go to the scene. Go ring the doorbell and ask the guy. Nobody does that. It's an art that's going to come back, however.
Breslin began writing a column for the old New York Herald Tribune and went on to toil for all three of the city's tabloids. In the mid-1980s, when Breslin wrote for the Daily News, he exposed a multi-million-dollar kickback scheme that resulted in the conviction of one of the city's major political bosses. Around the same time, he broke the story of city police using stun guns on suspects. Such writing provoked the ire of the police union, which took out full-page ads attacking the columnist. And Mayor Ed Koch, who Breslin referred to as Cop-Out Koch, and blamed for widespread corruption.
You know, Jimmy Breslin cuts the hell out of people every single day he has a column. And then on one occasion when in jocular mode and mood, after he's attacked me again, I say something about him, and suddenly he becomes wounded, like he's not allowed to be criticized.
Do you still read Breslin's column?
Of course I do. I happen to think that Jimmy Breslin is an excellent writer. A lot of fiction, but an excellent writer.
But when Breslin won his Pulitzer, it was for commentary, not fiction. Still, his detractors have repeatedly questioned whether some of the Runyon-esque characters in Breslin's newspaper column, including the arsonist he referred to as Marvin the Torch and a 400-pound bookie known as Fat Thomas, did in fact exist. But A.M. Rosenthal, the former executive editor of the New York Times, confirms that at the height of such suspicions, probably in the early 1970s, he ventured out to a bar in Queens with Breslin to check up on the veracity of these characters. Rosenthal met Fat Thomas and a member of the team that subsequently pulled a huge armored car heist in the city. According to novelist and newspaper man Pete Hamill, Breslin eventually soured on organized crime after seeing what heroin did in the city's ghettos. Hamill says Breslin's great triumph was not just putting a column in a newspaper, but adding voices to the city's chorus.
What he saw was that the guy you're sitting next to on the subway could have a dense, complicated, interesting life. I think he was trying to figure out, who are these people that I'm living with? And that kind of curiosity made him into a terrific reporter and a very good novelist.
Many who know Breslin personally say he isn't always a terrific human being. In 1990, Breslin angrily referred to a Korean-American colleague at Newsday as a yellow cur, prompting his suspension from the paper for 2 weeks. And over the years, Breslin has been notorious for promising to make personal appearances and then failing to show up. But Les Payne, an editor and columnist with Newsday, praises Breslin's lifelong dedication to the poor.
We say that in journalism. One of our goals is to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable, but we almost never do it. I mean, what we invariably do is to comfort the comfortable and continue to afflict the afflicted normally by ignoring them. And I think that one of the things that Breslin has done over the years is to pay some attention to the afflicted in ways that journalism preaches but so very often refuse to practice.
Jimmy Breslin turned 75 last month. He's seen a lot of change in the newspaper business over the course of his nearly 60-year career. The columnist contends that the changes have been healthy for journalists, but bad for readers, who get dailies with less thump than the old days.
At 5 o'clock at night in the New York Daily News, you couldn't see from one end of the city room to the other because of the smoke. A tremendous scene, looked like an old fight club. And the noise of the typewriters was loud, like subway train running through. And out of all this noise, smoke, came nervous energy. Words in a newspaper are made of nervous energy, and they had that. Afterwards, there was bars people went to, and you discussed how people wrote. There used to be discussions about writing styles at the bar. There's no such thing today. Afterwards, nobody goes to a saloon and discusses language, newspaper reporting language. They go to a health club, and then worst of all, they go home to their wives and families.
Breslin isn't retiring from writing a regular column to spend more time with his family. He'll write books and play a bishop in a motion picture based on the recent account he wrote of the pedophile priest scandal. A devout Catholic, Breslin stopped going to Mass because of the scandal, but insists he continues to follow the life of Christ. In a brief chat with OTM this week, the legendary columnist made a reference to the loss of his daughter Rosemary in June, saying, "I'm in very bad shape since this summer, but I'll get going again." For On the Media, I'm John Kalish in New York.
Thank you. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Ann Kosseff. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.